Beekeeping in Maine. This week's spring-like weather has some people dreaming about their vegetable gardens, others anticipating lazy days at the beach. But for many people in Maine, warm days in February are the best time to peek into the beehive and start getting the beekeeping equipment ready for the year. Beekeeping has exploded in popularity in Maine, with hundreds of new hobby beekeepers cropping up every year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn what it takes to get started as a beekeeper, how difficult it is, and what kind of time commitment it requires. We'll also discuss some of the threats to the bee population both here in Maine and around the world. And we'll talk about honey, the buzz on bees. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. All over Maine, from farms to urban backyards, beekeeping has become a popular hobby and sometimes a business. Today, we're going to learn what goes into beekeeping. Joining me in the studio, Jennifer Lund. She is the State of Maine Apiarist and Bee Inspector with the Maine Department of Agriculture. And Phil Gavin, is it Gavin or Govin?
Gavin.
Gavin, he's the proprietor of the Honey Exchange and a master beekeeper with the Eastern Apiculture Society. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been eager to get into beekeeping but don't know where to start? Or are you a longtime beekeeper with advice to share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jennifer, I don't think most people know about the Maine State Apiarist. What is an apiarist? What do you do for the state of Maine?
Thanks for having me. So what I do, I'm a lot of people refer to me as the state bee inspector. So what I do is I work with beekeepers and kind of help them with problems that they're having. I also inspect their hives if they're having issues and help them problem solve and come up with solutions. Really, my department's set up to prevent the spread of regulated pests and diseases and also unwanted genetic material, so things like Africanized bees. And so I spend a lot of time pretty much problem shooting with beekeepers about their issues. I also work with the migratory beekeepers. We get quite a few hives from out of state that come in for blueberry pollination. This year we had 37,000, a little bit more than that, that came in.
37,000 bees?
Or hives.
Hives. Okay.
Yes.
I was going to say it seemed like a low number for bees, but a high number for trucks.
No. Yeah. So 37,000 hives. And in previous years, we've had up to 80,000 that come up for pollination services in our blueberry crop and apples.
How did you get into bees?
Well, kind of by accident. So my training is in entomology in general. So I went to school for entomology, the study of insects, and I moved up to Maine 10 or a little bit more years ago, and I was working at the University of Maine, and I was approached by a professor who had just gotten some grant funding to do some honeybee research. And he offered the position to me, and I took it and never looked back. So I started my first year beekeeping with 5 of my own hives in my backyard and 40 research hives. So.
Wow, you jumped in with both feet.
Both feet.
And Phil, tell us your story. How did you get into it?
Oh, I was a stay-at-home dad for about 7 years and had maybe a little too much time on my hands and thought I'd been learning a lot about bees and beekeeping, and it's sort of been in the back of my mind since I knew a guy in college whose parents were beekeepers, and that was the first encounter I'd ever had with it. And I read a long article about colony collapse disorder and seemed like kind of a problem that maybe we should be working on, and thought I would have my one hive and it'd be my gentlemanly pastime. And like a lot of people, we say we go bee nerdy pretty deep, pretty fast. And
it becomes an addiction.
Well, yeah. So now
we go bee nerdy. I like that. Okay.
Yeah. And then skip ahead a few years. And when my kids were ready to get into middle school and didn't really need as much of my time, my wife and I tried to decide what we wanted to do when we grew up and decided that we would turn this, what had become a passion, into a business. And so we opened the Honey Exchange in 2011. To provide services and education to the beekeeping community and sell bees and beehive parts. And then support the beekeeping community with honey extraction in the summertime. And then we're also we're open every day but Monday as a gift store where you can come in and find all kinds of things, bee and honey and nature related. And
so it's going well.
Yeah, we're having a great time with it on Stevens Avenue.
When it opened in 2011, did you have any idea how much beekeeping was going to take off?
Well, we saw it taking off, and that was one of the reasons we thought it would be a good business model to jump into, because, you know, I thought I was an outlier in having this decision to make, you know, to become part of the solution rather than part of the problem in keeping bees. And it turns out that I wasn't an outlier at all. I was part of a huge nationwide trend of that happening all over. And so when we saw that trend happening, we thought, well, maybe we can get involved in a greater level and try to do more to support the local community.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the reasons to become a beekeeper. And, you know, I think both of you have mentioned one of them. Jennifer, you were talking about colony collapse. I think a lot of people have heard of that. What is that exactly? What does it mean when somebody says colony collapse?
So colony collapse is a term that was used kind of for this disorder that was happening in bees, where they were dying at large rates that was unexplained at the time.
This is about a decade ago?
About a decade ago. And now we know that it's actually a whole host of things that impact hives that are causing them to ultimately die. And so some of them being things like the varroa mite, which I'm sure we'll touch on later on. It's a big topic. But also, you know, poor nutrition, some of the other fungal diseases and pathogens that happen with bees. And so it's kind of a general term for hives that are dying from a bunch of different causes.
And there was a dramatic surge in this.
It just happened to be that a lot of our pests and pathogens and other issues all kind of came to a head at the same time in the beekeeping community. And so we had a bunch of pests that came in that were introduced that our bees have no kind of resilience towards, and that and they all kind of happened in the same time period, and that's where it came to a head.
So. And you mentioned, Phil, that that's why you got in. You want to be part of the solution. So the idea was that by raising bees, we could help compensate for all of those that were dying?
Yeah, to a degree. Just having more bees in the environment is always beneficial to the ecosystem. And also just trying to learn what's going on. I think there's some innovation that's happening in the backyard level where people are just trying to do what they can to keep their bees healthy. And if we can learn something in the backyard that we can then translate into a larger thing and get it to our commercial pollinators, it can make a really big difference in the food system.
And also providing education. So one of the things that Phil does is he's a master beekeeper, which one of their main passions is to teach new beekeepers. And so kind of teaching new beekeepers how good animal husbandry when it comes to bees and things to that nature really can also help promote good bee health.
I'm looking at the 2017-2018 Maine honeybee survey results, and I'd like you guys to explain something to me. Under the subtopic hive losses, this says respondents reported 43.4% loss between April 2017 and April 2018, and that this is down from a year with a 53% loss. Does that mean, Phil, that of all the hives out there that people are keeping, almost half will not succeed?
At this point, I wish I had a better, more hopeful answer than that, but it seems to be where we are. We're midway through a really rough winter already, and in my own yards, I've already lost half of my hives, and some of those were kind of on me for not having as much time to be the good beekeeper I want to be, but others were just, despite all the efforts that we put in, sometimes nature just doesn't make it.
So I want to get back to sort of the more positive spin then, which is why people become beekeepers, given these sort of frustrating statistics. I would think if I'm going to start a new hobby, I'd like something that has a pretty high chance of working. Maybe that's just my personality. Why would you want to become a beekeeper?
Oh, it's rewarding in a bunch of different ways. You know, we see a lot of hives dying in the winter, and winters are one of our biggest challenges here. Just the climate is a hard place to keep bees alive. But while the season is going on, it's a strange thing. I have a friend who's kind of tightly wound. He's one of those guys who just always seems to be ready to go. And the only time I see him physically relax is when he goes out to work his bees. And it's sort of you're forced into finding a certain amount of calm and removing yourself from the outside world and just focusing on this thing. Because if you're careless in a beehive, you know, things stop being fun when the bees start stinging you. But if you can be careful in it, you can sometimes spend an hour in a hive just looking through them and checking on their health and their food stores. And, you know, thousands of bees are flying around you. And to an outsider, it might seem daunting. But when you're in it, it's surprisingly calming. And so a lot of people just enjoy the act of going through the hive in the summertime while it's alive. And it's a little sad if they die in the wintertime. But we're all kind of chomping at the bit for springtime to come so we can get back in it.
Yeah, and I think it also follows the trend of people wanting to do more things outside, returning kind of to the outside world. So it gives you that connection with nature. You know, you tend your bees, but you also spend time looking to see what they're bringing back, what type of pollen, what type of nectar they're feeding on, you know, where you see them in your yard, you know, in your garden, places like that. And I think it really gives people a nice sense of connectiveness to the natural world around them.
Let's talk about honey. How much honey will a hive produce?
It varies hugely. On average, I think it's about 40 to 50 pounds in Maine. But that's an average that's made by some years. Like the year before last, when we had a really dry summer, there was very little honey to harvest in the fall. And so sometimes beekeepers take zero. In a really good year, which I think happens about once a decade, we might get 100 pounds of honey from a hive.
Wow, that is really a huge variety. So Phil mentioned when we harvest in the fall. So walk me through, Jennifer, the sort of the rhythm of the season for beekeeping. It's February now, and this is the time when beekeepers start kind of gearing up, right?
Right. We're beekeepers, what they're doing now is they're repairing any, you know, damaged equipment, getting ready, buying new equipment if they need it, ordering bees if they've had some losses or if they're going to be starting new, reading all their bee journals and bee books and getting ready for the season. Phil and I were talking beforehand, the nice weather that we've had the last couple of days, I've been getting some calls, and so is he, about beekeepers who are checking in on their hives. So during warm weather, throughout the winter, every time we get around 40, 50 degrees, the bees will come out and fly. And so you can check to see if your hives are still alive at that point. And so that's really fun for beekeepers on those warm days. And then we start getting to the spring. The bees start producing brood and increasing in size. And then they have their first nectar flow. When does that usually happen down here?
Depends on when spring comes. Usually the last week of April or last week of March. Depends
so last week of March in southern Maine, what about further north and east?
It varies by a couple weeks, so a couple weeks later usually.
Yeah. So right now I'm watching my silver maple trees in the neighborhood. And when those blooms come out and you see the bees on the silver maples, that's the beginning of beekeeping season. And that's sometimes around St. Patrick's Day.
What are you all hearing? You said the last couple of days, when it gets to be above 40, 50 degrees and sunny, people can sort of do a little spying on their hive and see how it's doing. Are you hearing good news so far?
It's mixed. I talked to a beekeeper yesterday who called, and all of his are alive. I actually checked on mine when I got home. All mine are alive, which is good. But you've had some calls that...
Yeah, well, this is the time of year where we sell packages of bees in the spring, and so we got a lot of calls yesterday from people who realized that their hives weren't alive. And that can be kind of disheartening after you take that call 17 times in a day. Mm. But at the same time, I got calls, and I myself went out, and you'd be surprised how excited people get about bee poop on the top of the snow, because that's all the bees are doing right now is they're trying to get out so they can poop, because they don't do that inside the hive. And so when you're a beekeeper and you go out and you see just this sort of sprinkling of mustard-colored drops around the hive. It's like, yay, bee poop. It's a strange thing to get excited about.
Back to saying we get bee nerdy. Okay. Jen, I want to come back to something you said at the very beginning. You mentioned that you wanted to make sure there were not Africanized bees. What does that mean? And how does that happen? And what are you looking for?
So a couple decades ago, there was a push to increase honey production in our European honeybees that we normally keep. And so there was some crossbreeding between bees that came out of Africa, and they tend to be a little too aggressive. and so they can cause problems. We mostly see it in southern states where there's stinging incidences, and they can actually send people to the hospital.
So this crossbreeding was done with the best intentions of trying to make a hardier bee stock, but it didn't work out that way.
It didn't work out. Well, I mean, they still do make a lot of honey, but unfortunately their temperament is not one that most beekeepers want to deal with. So
they're more likely to sting?
More likely to sting and more likely to their alarm pheromone, they get really riled up and then they will multiply sting. So you'll get lots and lots of stings. Hundreds and thousands of stings all at the same time.
So what do you do if somebody says that they think they have some Africanized bees?
We go out and check and we look for their temperament. There's a couple tests you can do, which usually involves disturbing the hive and seeing what their reaction is. Unfortunately, it's not very common in Maine. Usually if we have a hive that is aggressive for some reason, we figure out the reason and then solve it. And typically it tends to be skunks or some other vertebrate that's getting into the hive and kind of disturbing it at night. And then during the day, it's a little more agitated than it should be.
Phil, what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about beekeeping?
Misconceptions.
When you have folks in your beginner class, what notion do you need to disabuse them of right away?
Well, if they've gotten into my beginner class already, you know, they've kind of crossed that threshold of they're always a few beats off of normal. And that's the people we like hanging around with. I think to outsiders, when they see someone who's, you know, sticking their bare hands into a hive that might have 50 or 60,000 things that can sting, you know, it's hardwired into our brain when we're born that we're supposed to be scared of these yellow and black things that buzz around our face. And so your fear instinct is just something that's part of being a human. Shedding that takes a few years. Learning to not flinch when a bee lands on you takes a long time. But when somebody who hasn't ever been in a beehive sees one open, the assumption is these bees are going to just jump out of the hive and get all over me and immediately start stinging me. And that's rarely the case. I mean, with an Africanized hive, that's one of their, you know, things that tips us off that they're not fun to be around. But with an ordinary hive, you should be able to just open up the lid to it, put a little puff of smoke to calm everybody down. And just work with them while they fly around you. And occasionally there's some guard bees. You know, there's a small population that's their job assignment of the day is to just fly around and try to scare everybody away. And those are the ones who are going to be flying around your face. That's why we wear a veil. And just, you know, we're mostly calling their bluff. The bees don't want to sting because when they do, they die. So they're just trying to scare us off because they know that's a good way to get us away from the hive. And if you can just stand there and remain calm, and, you know, that's the thing you have to do to cross that threshold.
We're talking about beekeeping on Maine Calling today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And UMaine's Collins Center, with Notzel Brass Cirque, a circus-style show with brass instruments, February 8th. CollinsCenterForTheArts.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Vogelzang, President and CEO of Maine Public. Our Super Thursday Pledge Drive is right around the corner, February 7th, and it's the right time to stand up and support your NPR station, Maine Public Radio, with a financial gift, either monthly or one time. The need for independent journalism, quality in-depth programming, and trusted content has never been greater. And I'll also share with you that this public radio station reaches more Mainers each week and touches more lives than at any time in our history, thanks to the many contributions, large and small, that come from over 50,000 households every year. So please step up and do your fair share, maybe even a little bit more than you've done in the past, on Super Thursday the 7th. Together, we'll take care of the business of public radio so that this independent, trusted news service remains strong and vibrant. Note also that if you'd like to pledge now and help us toward those goals, you can online at mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Bees have been inspiring people for a long time. Of course, that's Flight of the Bumblebees. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, today on the program all about beekeeping. Joining me in the studio, Phil Gaffin, owner of the Honey Exchange and master beekeeper with the Eastern Apiculture Society, and Jennifer Lund, Maine State apiarist and bee inspector. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We have a tweet from Nissa. She says, "Are there ways to help wild pollinators in our yards? I used to keep bees, but have developed a fructose intolerance, so I can't eat or use honey. Still, I want to help my local bees."
Absolutely. There are lots of ways that people who don't want to become beekeepers can help native bee populations. And one of the biggest ones is providing forage. So having planting flowers around your yard that the bees can use to collect nectar from and pollen, having them kind of overlap throughout the whole entire seasons can also promote them in your yard, and also providing habitat. So a lot of our native bees are solitary. They don't form colonies like honeybees do, and they nest in things like wood blocks or in the ground in sandy soil. And so having places like that available for them can really increase your populations in your local habitat.
Philip on Facebook says, "I'd like to keep bees, but I just learned that my neighbor about 100 feet away is starting a 20-acre hemp commercial farm. Do Jennifer and Phil have any advice on mitigating exposure to the bees from that?"
It's not an area of expertise that I know a great deal about, but as far as I know, it's not something that should interfere. I don't think that bees really work hemp plants. It's not a nectar plant for them. It's not a pollen plant for them. So I'd be surprised if they spend any time over there at all.
There you go. Let's see here. We will go to Tom calling from Gorham. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello. I am under the impression that milk cows are bred and have evolved over the years to overproduce milk so that they're more for domestic production than to just feed their own calves. My question is, why do bees make so much bloody honey? They certainly don't need it all. You can't take 100 pounds of honey out of a hive that they're dependent upon for their own survival and have them survive. So how is it that honeybees overproduce such honey? Is it by breeding or under encouragement? Do you sing to them? How do you make them do that?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're essentially taking advantage of their incredible work ethic. Bees, they love to work. It's what they live and die for. They just get up in the morning and like, yeah, I get to go to work again. It's so exciting. And so in nature, if a hive was going to find its own place to live, they tend to find places that are about 10 gallons in size in their total volume. And that's a space where they can fill it up with enough honey to survive on their own through the winter, but it's not so big that they are having to heat a too big home. Part of the art of beekeeping is trying to stretch the natural instinct of the bees. And so the colonies that we put them in tend to be twice or three times what they would choose naturally if they were left to their own choosing. In that smaller space that they would choose, they're also going to reproduce once or maybe twice or three times a season. And so we don't want them doing that without our kind of involvement in it and splitting hives and dividing them that way. So if we just allow them to grow into this unnaturally large space, they'll make the 100 pounds of honey that they need for themselves. And in a good year, they may make that much again. And that's the part that we'll harvest.
Tom, good question. Thank you. We'll go to Henry calling from Reedfield. Hi, Henry. Go ahead.
Hi. This is Henry Whittemore from Reedfield, and I was a beekeeper for 20 years. I lapsed out of it after having lost a couple of hives and really having much less success in the last 10 years of my being a beekeeper in successfully overwintering hives. And as I think about maybe getting back into it, I wonder whether all the interventions we can provide to our colonies as beekeepers, chemical interventions to control varroa mites and tracheal mites and the other nasty things that happen to them, how necessary that is versus what sort of natural approach to beekeeping is plausible in this day and age with all of these nasty things that are attacking our colonies.
So that's a really good question. So I like to look at pest management in hives in a two-prong approach. So prevention and then intervention. And so with prevention, you're going to be doing things in that hive that keep the pest populations low, so they're not damaging the hive. So things like, for instance, varroa mite. What you would use things like screen bottom boards or drone brood trapping to keep those levels low as long as possible. And then once those populations of pests get high enough, that's when you would go in and use a miticide to knock them back down. And so using those pesticide treatments sparingly and only when they're needed is really a good way to lessen the effects that they have in the hive other than their intended target. And so using a kind of a more integrated, we call it integrated pest management approach, is really the way to go about that and kind of hit it from both sides. So kind of taking the more natural approach and then using those miticides when it's necessary.
Yeah, and just to tie onto that, when we talk about miticides, you know, back in the day, 10, 20, 30 years ago, people were using exclusively man-made chemicals in their hives to try to kill the mites. Very few beekeepers are using those artificial chemicals anymore. What we're using are natural treatments like thymol is made from oil of thyme. Formic acid is a naturally occurring organic acid. Hop guard is made from the beta acids of hops. So they're things that are existing in nature. They're not made in a laboratory. And most beekeepers I know are using just the naturally based treatments, and you can still label a honey organic if you're using the right things.
Henry, thanks for your call. And I have a quick correction. The song coming out of the break was not The Flight of the Bumblebees. It was The Bee by Franz Schubert. Phil, how do you get started? You're listening to this program and thinking, well, okay, I've kind of thought about this for a while. Now I'm really thinking about it. I hear this is the time of year to get started.
Yeah, the answer is different if you ask me how I got started from how I recommend other people get started. I just kind of had bungled my way through, and I bought some textbooks, and I found all kinds of things at the library. Looking back on it, I wish I had taken a beekeeping class. So we offer those at the Honey Exchange, and they're offered a few other places around the state. And we really encourage people to do that. We teach a 10-hour class, and when I send my students out into the world after class number 5, I feel like I've just skimmed the surface in 10 hours of what you really should know to keep your hives healthy and thriving. So taking a class is a good way to just get the start on your start. And then once you've got that, you're going to order some equipment and some fundamental tools that you have to have. Most beekeepers in their first season are going to spend between $700 and $1,000 to get a couple of hives up and running. You need to buy your tools and your protective gear. So those things you only have to buy once. And the hive parts, you need a hive per colony. And then you need to get the colonies to start with. And so the thing that a lot of people forget about, like sometimes we'll have people come in the spring like, oh, I'm gung-ho to get a hive going right now. But if you haven't thought about it essentially at this time of the year, you miss your chance to take a class. And also you miss your chance to order bees. We usually sell out of our packaged bees by the first week of March. And most everybody is going to sell out of those in March or early April, even though they're going to be delivered at the end of April or the middle of May, depending on where they're coming from.
So I would like to add on to that, too. One of the really good strategies for also a new beekeeper is to join your local clubs, so your local beekeeping clubs. They're filled with lots of beekeepers who have been through it all and are really willing to talk about bees. If anything, we talk about bees.
We're really we're kind of spoiled here in Maine with, we have a state apiarist program that some people don't realize is going on. But because of the importance of our blueberry crop, it's a surprisingly robust department. Other states don't really have that kind of coverage. Yeah. We're really lucky with that. And then also we have the state association and then the local county clubs. There's a lot of support that you can get in Maine, whereas I've visited beekeepers in New York and New Jersey, and we talk about bee school, and they're like, they don't even know what that is.
Yeah, so. And getting a mentor from one of those clubs, a beekeeper who has experience, is really important too, your first year and second year.
We'll go to Lamar calling from Litchfield. Hi, Lamar. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I was wondering if anyone there had any experience with the flow hives that I've seen, like a GoFundMe or a Kickstarter page for, because I'm someone that's also interested in helping bees, but I don't want to spend a lot of time like pulling them open and messing around with them. So I was wondering if anyone had heard of those and what they thought of them.
Yeah, we hear a lot about, you nodded that one off. The flow hive is, it's two things to me. First of all, it's an indication that people really care and want to help with bees. You know, that company, they went looking for some startup funding. I think they were looking for like $70,000 or $80,000, and they ended up raising like $20 million to start their company. So it's a huge success story. It's from a company in Australia, and that's really, really relevant because in Australia, it's a very different climate from what we have. They've got summer that lasts 11 months of the year. It's hot when it's hot. I mean, here when we complain about it's hot, it's like 85 degrees, and it's not even remotely hot compared to the rest of the globe.
And they also don't have varroa mites.
Yeah, they don't have varroa mites there. So my wife likes to say it's a problem it's a solution in search of a problem. It's getting honey out of the hive is not your biggest challenge in keeping bees. The biggest challenge is getting in there and making sure that they're healthy and that they're thriving and that they're well fed. And the flow hive, you just turn a little knob and in theory, honey will flow out of it. But if that honey's cured fully or not, we don't know without looking inside the hive. If it's September in Maine, honey is not going to flow like it does in Australia when it's 115 degrees. It's going to flow much more slowly. And so it's not a mechanism that's really designed for the temperature ranges that we have here. And also, because that sits on the top of your hive and it exists only for the harvesting of honey, it's an impediment to getting into the core of the hive and seeing how they're doing, because all of that we're going to learn from looking at where their nest is. You know, is their queen laying a lot of eggs? Are those eggs developing into healthy larvae? Are those bees being born healthy and productive? And do they go out and gather enough food and bring it back? And so those questions are left unanswered if you always have this thing in your way. And so it's a great idea. It's wonderful if you live in Australia. It seems wholly inappropriate for this climate, though.
All right, Lamar, good luck to you. We'll go to Griff calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Griff. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. First, I just want to say hi to Jen. I got the pleasure of working with her at University of Maine.
Hi, Griff.
I'm in there. Hi, Jen. So cool to see you doing this. And I actually do have a question. Out in Cape Elizabeth, I'm surrounded by these wonderful neighbors, but they're obsessed with keeping their lawns super green and perfect, and I don't know what they're using to do that. And so it worries me if I want to keep hives, you know, what are the bees bringing back with them from these perfectly manicured landscapes that I see a lot of weird input going into. So do you have any advice for me there?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. There's been quite a bit of research on looking at kind of landscaping and manicured lawns and how impactful that is on bee populations. And we find that the bees actually are really uninterested in people's lawns. So they're really hanging out in the areas where you're seeing flowers and dandelions. So those lawns that are not as manicured, that's really where they're spending most of their time. And so if there's not flowers for them there, you won't see them. So they're not being impacted by those pesticides. There is an issue with reduced forage, of course, if people are manicuring their lawns and there's no dandelions. There's nothing better for a beekeeper. We all love seeing dandelions in yards.
Oh, it's the best.
It's the best. And so so there is an issue with reduced forage in the area. But other than that, the impacts of those, typically what they're using as herbicides and fertilizers, is not very big on the hives.
So you say to Griff, yes, it's safe to keep bees.
Keep your bees.
Yeah, there's some very good bees in Cape Elizabeth. It tends to be a really healthy place to keep them.
Yeah.
You know, the lawns are one thing, but the bees are just going to fly past that. What they have in Cape Elizabeth is there's an enormous amount of Japanese knotweed, which for gardeners, it's the
right.
It's
when
the
we
enemy.
Do our gardening show,
exactly.
We always get calls. That's right.
And you do want to devote your life to beating that back to the end of the property. But there's so much of it out there that the bees are just going to go and find it. You know, it's running along the railroad tracks, and it's under the power lines, and it's all those kind of unused places all around southern Maine.
How far will a bee go looking for the flower or knotweed that it likes?
They'll travel for about 2 miles around their hive. A mile and a half is kind of their perfect zone where they can get back with an increase in calories that they haven't expended going to get it.
Will right. they go that far if they don't have to?
If they don't have to, they'll stay close. Yeah. So ideally, if they can get it closer and bring back plenty of calories and nectar that they haven't expended to fly and get it, and that's when they start putting on weight.
Well, Griff, good luck to you. Our phone number here, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about beekeeping, and we'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi. In Portland and at tandemcoffee.com. And Waterville Creates, inviting you to learn more about plans for the Downtown Arts Center in Waterville. Details online at downtownartscenter.org.
Just a decade ago, we saw one of the worst global recessions in history.
Nobody predicted the financial crisis.
It felt like we were in economic war.
Have we learned our lesson? Is the system any safer?
If you feel safer about anything right now, you're dreaming.
I'm John Donvan. On Intelligence Squared US, we ask, 10 years after the global financial crisis, is the system safer?
Coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. The third season of High School Quiz Show Maine gets underway this week. This year, over 60 teams competed for the final 16 positions to battle it out over math, science, history, popular culture, and current events, and take part in Maine Public Television's weekly Thursday evening contest. To kick things off this week, we have a doubleheader as Scarborough takes on Rockland's Oceanside and Falmouth goes up against Brewer, Thursday evening from 8 to 9. The rebroadcast will be Sunday from 5 to 6. Information about High School Quiz Show Maine is at mainepublic.org. Click on television.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Bees, Honey, and Being a Beekeeper. Here with me, Jennifer Lund, state apiarist, and Phil Gavin with the Honey Exchange. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, I want to ask you all, though, I read this morning there are more than 300 types of honey. Amazing. If your bees are sort of free range, how do you control what kind of honey they're making? How is it clover honey or knotweed honey or something else? Blueberry honey?
We usually call that wildflower honey.
The bees don't care about my opinion. It's beyond my control. You can do plantings around if you've got a lot of acreage, but they're just going to go out and find what they like the best.
So how does one determine what kind of honey? How does somebody who's selling it say this is
Some honeys you can tell. So something like a buckwheat honey is really dark, and so it's got a relatively distinctive flavor. Knotweed honey is very similar.
So I think 300 is actually a really low number, because everywhere you go in the world, there's different things blooming, and even if there's a certain similarity, there's going to be a nuance to everything.
So is there a best honey? Is there a honey that everybody is sort of seeking and hopes to create?
Not really. At the Honey Exchange, we sell about 50 different types of honey. And I thought there would be, the one thing that everybody loves. And we do have, there's a star thistle honey that we sell from Michigan that's just exquisite. It tastes like cake frosting. And so the sweet tooth crowd goes right for that. But then other people just only like things that are really, really dark. Other people only like things that are really, really light. Some people like it when it's thick and spreadable. Other people want it to be liquid for different reasons. And it's just all over the map. It just depends on what appeals to you as a person.
Teresa asks on an email, are there bad bees? My garden tends to be visited by bumblebees. Is that okay? And then do the bees your guest raised recognize them? So let's ask the first one. Is there such a thing as a bad bee? Nope.
Well, we have a couple species of native bees that are invasive of non-native bees that are invasive that cause problems for some of our native bees. They're a little territorial and won't let them forage. But typically what you're seeing is bumblebees are good.
Yeah. I've seen the honeybees interacting a little bit with the bumblebees, but most things they're going to forage on things that are specific to the length of their tongue.
Right.
And they're going to do different times of the day. So the bumblebees tend to get up earlier and stay up later. They're visiting, I don't know exactly which.
Do bumblebees make honey?
They collect nectar and pollen, bring it back for themselves, but they don't make a surplus. They don't
enough
store the future.
Enough to
right.
harvest.
Yeah, just
right.
Honeybees are making something that's going to last.
Yeah, and bumblebees have a long tongue, and so they're tending to their aim is those flowers that have long kind of nectar reservoirs, and honeybees and a lot of our smaller native bees can't access that. So
do your bees, and she asked, do your bees, your guest rays, recognize them? Do your bees recognize you?
Oh,
like,
recognize
like
me
your
as a
dog
person?
Might?
That's the subject of some debate. I have friends who really believe that to be true. I I want to believe it's true, but then there are some days when I go out there and I'm this benevolent caregiver and I'm doing everything I can to help them, and yet sometimes they just want me to go away and they're unkind to me. So I'm not sure. Do your bees know you, Jen?
I'm not convinced they do.
Okay. We'll go to Bill calling from Whiting. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, good day. Good show, and always fun to tune in. I keep bees down here in Washington County, and I had spoken with Jen earlier in the year, or late last year, you know, about some of the issues that you guys have been bringing to the airtime today. There was some commentary to Phil, you know, asking about what misconceptions people might have. And one of the first things that people always say to me when they hear that I keep bees is that, oh, boy, you must put them on the blueberry fields. And I try very hard to let people know, you know, contrary to popular belief, there really isn't much wild about Maine wild blueberries. But the hired guns that come to pollinate those, they're only here for about 2 weeks. And I frequently comment that my bees like to eat year-round instead of just during that two-week period. And so a few years ago, I made a move to park most of my stock on farms that are local that are often organic-rated and provide goods to farmers markets and co-ops and things like that. And the bees began to flourish because they had some of the very best forage that they could hope for, because these farmers, of course, are using best practices for their own, you know, needs. And it was obvious that carrying capacity was the thing, and that was one of the things that Jen and I talked about was, you know, oftentimes people will have too many hives and too small a concentration, and there just isn't the capacity to keep them. I did keep some in a small yard near my home where I'm surrounded by blueberry fields, and the last 2 years there was about a 50% decrease in bees coming in, as Jen had alluded to, but that was because of the fact a lot of berry growers decided to let their grounds go fallow and just didn't plant. And I'm amazed that after just, or not plant, but to cultivate the berries, and I'm amazed that just after one or two cycles, how many hundreds of acres have been put back into production for wildflowers simply because they haven't been rolled and, you know, fumigated.
Sure, Bill. Yeah, and I do think we'll be doing a main calling on what's going on with the blueberries. We have a bunch of people who want to call, so wondering if you have a question for our guests.
No, just, you know, I'm glad that the program is there at the state level, and we do use it for inspections and that sort of thing. And I think I go into the next couple of years with a little more optimism simply because of the fact there is an awareness, and we have the program and process in place, and education is starting to take hold. So, comments?
Well, thank you, Bill. Thanks for calling in today. We'll go to Louie, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Louie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because I had a question about your thoughts on small-scale or urban beekeeping. I mean, I live in an urban environment, and I've been thinking about beekeeping for a while now. It just seems like so many bees involved. In a perfect world, I'd probably be comfortable with, like, one bee. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. One hive?
How many bees in a hive?
It depends on the time of year. It ranges between 8 or 10,000 to 50 or 60,000. So bee is going to be fewer than you need. There's a surprising amount of small-scale beekeeping happening in Portland and other towns like that. Urban beekeeping has become very trendy. Like Brooklyn is one of the hot spots for beekeeping in the United States.
Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York, yeah. this year, one of the highlights of our past season was we helped the people at the Press Hotel. The chef from the Union Restaurant wanted to put hives on the roof. So they now have hives on the roof of the building at the Press Hotel, and they are thriving. They were out flying yesterday because they're just doing really well. So the city of Portland is a great place to keep bees, as it turns out, because the city's been planting flowering trees for decades, and so we've got linden trees and hawthorn trees and maple trees that make for really abundant food sources for the bees. And then, of course, the Japanese knotweed that we already talked about, that and the goldenrod that kind of creeps in the in-between areas, they tend to be really healthy in an urban environment.
Yeah, there's been a huge upturn in urban beekeeping over the last 5-10 years. There's lots of resources online that you can look up to kind of mitigate any problems you may have with neighbors. And so if you send me an email, I can send you a list of things to do to make it so it's less impactful for your neighbors.
Thanks, Louie, for calling in. You mentioned problems with neighbors. You know, I'm wondering, is that a concern if I live in an urban area and I have a couple hives and the neighbor's kid gets stung? Am I going to get sued? Is that something that is a concern?
It's something that beekeepers worry about perhaps more than they should. You know, I know everybody worries about it. Some people have insurance for that. You know, at this store we carry a lot of liability insurance for that. But I don't know of any actual real-world examples
heard of,
it becoming a genuine problem.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of schools, middle, high, and elementary schools that are now bringing hives onto their campuses. So, you know, the risk is there, but we can be careful about it.
South Portland High School, they have hives right on school property, and they just fly around. There's a chain link fence around them, so they fly up and over the fence, and you can go and look at them any day of the year.
Yep.
The one thing about schools that we've learned is because there's so many peanut allergies and latex allergies that are going on, that schools have EpiPens on campus, and there are people that know how to use them. So it's actually the safest place in the world to be stung by a bee if you happen to have a bee sting allergy.
Tweet from Caitlin: my dad always said local honey can make one less sensitive to pollen and help with allergies. Is this just true or just one of those things dads say?
There's an old adage about 50 million Elvis fans can't all be wrong. And I think there's some validity in that. We meet people every day coming in the store to buy local honey because it has helped them. So whether or not it's all psychological, I'll leave that for the doctors to sort out. But there are certainly plenty of people who have found relief from pollen allergies.
Okay, we'll go to Katie in Bath. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi there. So we just recently moved to Bath, and I'm curious about lead content in soil. I know we have to have raised beds for any sort of gardens, any vegetables we're eating. Does lead show up in honey?
Not to my knowledge. There's actually a study that's going on right now with the Kennebec Estuary Land Trust.
Yep.
And they're able to measure what's coming back on pollens, and they can actually find very small trace heavy metals residues on some pollen. But the amounts that it's coming in are, you know, parts per billion. And so it's a really, really small amount.
Something
that's going to be harmful to anybody's health.
All right. Good question, Katie. Barbara on Facebook says, I once set my audio recorder at a hive door to really get close to their sounds. I was struck by the harmonies they created. They were naturally put off by the foreign object at their door, but soon either ignored or crawled over it. Also stuck the recorder in the blooming thyme, then in the lawn to compare the level of pollinator activity. Big difference. No surprise to you all, right?
No.
We'll go to Kurt, who's calling from Poland. Hi, Kurt. Go ahead. Kurt, are you there? Okay, I'll move on. We'll go to Martha from Naples. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Hi there. My question is about honey. How can one be sure that one is buying pure honey and not something that's been mixed with corn syrup?
Buying it directly from your beekeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or from somebody who knows their beekeepers. You know?
Yes.
So we have suppliers by the dozens who we get to know and establish a relationship that they're actually beekeepers harvesting honey from real beehives.
Is that a major problem? Is honey mislabeled in the grocery store?
There have been some examples of that. You know, again, fortunately, we have a federal government that does a pretty good job of controlling our food supply. But sometimes things will sneak in. It's very difficult to tell without, you know, really careful chemical analysis if it's just sugar syrup or corn syrup. But, you know, at a reliable shop or a beekeeper that you know, or farmers markets where you're meeting the person who's actually harvesting the honey, those are reliable sources.
An email from Jennifer: at our 7-acre home in Kennebunkport, which is all natural, we host 2 beehives and split the cost with our neighbors. Beekeepers Peggy and Richard McLaughlin bring the hives to us in the spring and maintain them while we get to watch their activity all summer long and then split the honey with the beekeepers. It's a win-win and a delight for the whole family to enjoy watching these docile but charming bees. So, well, that sounds like a nice option if you want to enjoy bees but not do the work. Is this something that's common throughout Maine and not just Kennebunkport?
It's not super common through Maine, but it is common enough that there are people who will rent out their hives for backyard pollination or enjoyment. It's becoming more popular across the United States. There are companies that do this in Boston and other large cities, and so it's becoming more popular.
We'll go to Tom in Falmouth. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. And if you can be quick, that'd be great.
I will. I entertained a beehive and checked with my town code enforcement, and I guess they consider bees an animal, so there are restrictions on the amount of acreage that you can put beehives in.
Yeah, there are some towns that still have an ordinance on their books. You know, I live in South Portland, and there's an ordinance of what we should and shouldn't do, and we pay a fee to register hives with the city. I think Westbrook has a similar ordinance. There are a few towns that still have a really restrictive ordinance in what you can do, and you may find that if you broach the subject and try to get a city councilor on your side who wants to change that ordinance, you may find that you've got public opinion on your side of taking that off the books.
Chris on Facebook says, I've read that you should start with at least two hives. Can you start with just one, or is two the minimum?
You can start with one, but it's often difficult to – so the reason why we suggest starting with two is you can compare them as that first season, because hives are very different. And so seeing one that's maybe struggling, you would not recognize that if you didn't have one next to it that was doing well.
Yeah, and you can also use one hive to solve problems for the
Absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely.
By having two, your success possibilities go up by much greater than a factor of two, because you can do this problem solving. And, you know, if something's going wrong with one queen, you can use the resources from the successful queen to
help
get
it.
That hive queen right again.
Yep.
An email from Doug, and quickly he says, I've been interested in this for years. Can you say again how to find out about beginner classes? And I can say, Doug, that we've put a link on our Maine Calling Facebook page to the Maine Beekeepers Association. But the Beekeepers Association has a pretty extensive list of classes. I know if you're in Portland, you can go to the Honey Exchange, but all over the state, Cooperative Extensions and other organizations hold them, correct?
Yes, and we'll be starting our second round of classes in the last week of February, so we still have some room left in our Honey Exchange classes. And also, we offer an intro to beekeeping for kids under 18. So if you're the younger set and you want to have something that's kind of geared toward them and try to be the coolest kid in your school, we've got a class on March 23rd for that.
The coolest kid in your school. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Phil Gavin, the proprietor of the Honey Exchange. He's a master beekeeper with the Eastern Apiculture Society. And Jennifer Lund, the state of Maine apiarist and bee inspector with the Maine Department of Agriculture. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.